Hi everybody, hope you're well. My name is Jim Carroll. Welcome you to the weekly podcast from the Banter team. It's very rare that we get to feature an MTV Video Music Award nominee at Banter, but Brendan Canty can now call himself that. The Cork video director and filmmaker was nominated for his work on Hozier's Take Me to Church. During Eventbrite's Do Business Better series in Cork over the summer, Brendan spoke to us about how he got started, the various wins in his career so far, the Hozier effect, the other projects he's involved with, and his motivation.
Hi folks, welcome along to Eventbrite here in Cork. My name is Jim Carroll, this is Banter. Thanks so much to Anne and the Eventbrite team for inviting me along. Banter is a well-travelled, old-school series of talking shops. We've been doing it since July 2009 in various venues all around the country. We're headquartered in the Twisted Pepper in Dublin, but we've done them at various festivals like the Electric Picnic, Body and Soul, Ballymun Literary Festival, Bloom in the Park, Big Grill, Savour, many, many festivals. Basically, we talk shite about a lot of things. This series of kind of panel discussions and also a series of one-on-one interviews. It covers a whole wide spectrum of things, everything from, I suppose, kind of food, politics, technology and media, right through to music, craft beer, masculinity, feminism, David Bowie and Bruce Springsteen. So we've covered a lot of ground. So when Anne kind of said to us, do you want to do something in Cork? I said, yes, we've been here before, it's been great. We've done stuff in the old pavilion, we did stuff in there, and we also did stuff at an amazing venue called the Mountain Dew Festival. And along the way, you kind of meet various people, and one of the people we met along the way was this fellow here, Brendan Canty. So please give him a round of applause. Brendan Canty from Feel Good Lost. I'm going to leave my iPad closed. I'm going to remember the question in my head, you know?
Yeah.
So it's like, okay, Feel Good Lost is kind of a very interesting series of collaborators. But before Feel Good Lost, what were you doing? I mean, like, you know, what's your background?
I started off wanting to be a football coach. And I was coaching with the FAI just at summer camps and stuff like that. But I was always very, I guess, creative. My mother was an artist, went to art college and stuff. So there was always that side to me. In transition year, I made a short film, and I met someone who was into that, and he asked me, did I want to make a short? And I was really into it. So I threw myself into that and had the most fun I've ever had in my life. And the friends I made during that became my best friends. So after that, I just kept making films, and that's kind of how I grew into making or wanted to be a filmmaker.
Mm. I mean, those for shorts. I mean, who was your, like, what were you seeking to emulate? Who were you seeking to be inspired by?
I don't know really. Like, for the very first one, we were just, I can't say there was, like, I wasn't the director on the first one, so it was just a case of having fun. I guess it would have been kind of an Anchorman-y sort of thing, you know,
yeah.
Just comedy sketches, messing around with your friends, but soon we knew it kind of came together. Then we made a second film, which we thought was way better, but looking back, it was actually kind of worse, where we did try to emulate things, probably like Tarantino sort of movies,
yeah,
or that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And yeah, but it wasn't really about, because I wasn't really taking it seriously. It wasn't really like, let's emulate these films. It was more just like, it's more just fun and crack, and it just kind of came together nicely, you know.
Yeah. Was it the case then, Brendan, like, you know, when you think about what to do after you left school, that you wanted to kind of, like, I mean, do something regarding films and do something regarding creative, which you hadn't kind of realised you can make a living from it? Which came first? I mean, do you think it was a case of, like, you know, that creative impetus was there before you realised you could actually make a living from it?
I knew I didn't exactly want to be a filmmaker. I knew it was a big part of what I wanted to do, but I wasn't exactly sure that's what I wanted to do. At the time, I was doing a lot of like graphic design and posters. My dad works in kind of PR and was doing stuff for some pubs in town, and I was designing the posters for him. So I wasn't sure, did I want to go into graphic design or filmmaking? So I picked a course in CIT, multimedia, which kind of covered a lot of bases. So that kind of suited, and it wasn't like I was unsure of what I wanted to do. I kind of knew I wanted to do a bit of everything, and I guess that's what kind of Feel Good Lost grew out of a bit.
Yeah. So I mean, like, in many ways, Feel Good Lost is kind of like the real world version of what you're doing in college.
Feel Good Lost is a job I created so I could do everything that I wanted to do.
It's a good way. It's a good way of putting it.
Yeah.
Like, you know, say, let's go back to that kind of like that CIT course. You know, like, did you learn anything of that? Did you, like me, was just learned the basics, the techniques?
It was multimedia was like any course. It was like it had its good things and it had its bad things, and I felt that you would learn skills, but the best thing about it was you had to make a film, so you were always constantly, I guess, doing it or working on it. Like, I got very frustrated with the course in the last 2 years, mainly because it seemed to be pushing away from filmmaking and pushing into a territory that they weren't even teaching in the course, which sounds a bit strange. I'm sure they are now, but multimedia was a very new course, and they were trying to, like, bring it into this new media sort of field, like kind of, they call it, there's this device called Arduino, and they were just obsessed with it. It's basically like a sensor, so like a media that to do with like sensors and interactivity.
Yeah.
And like, but in the last 2 years, it was like, all our projects were driven towards being about this, and yet we had no class in this field or whatever. And I had a very, like, we had a module in filmmaking every single year, and by the final year, I was told that I can't make. Well, I was able to make it, but they gave me a hard time about doing my film, even though filmmaking was part of the course. So it was kind of frustrating in that sense. But going back to your question, there was always, like, I guess, real basics in the course, but the best thing about it was you constantly had to make films. You had to do this.
Yeah.
You had to, like, web design is a good example. The course is very driven for web design, and I was terrible at web design. In fact, the only thing I was good at in the web design part of it was being able to copy other people's code and rework it and change it enough so it looks like I wasn't cheating. And essentially, that's kind of what web design is, because once you can take people's
code. That was a big step. Someone told me that once, I didn't believe it. Then I went off and saw, yeah, actually, that's how you do it.
But when it's copy and paste. Like, when I couldn't be able to design your website from start to finish. But when I left the course and I needed my own website, I found a website I really liked, took all the code, managed to take all the CSS, and I'm a good designer, so I was able to, like, make it look the way I wanted. And by the end, it looked nothing like the original site, except I ripped all their codes. So, I don't know what my point is, but, like, the course was kind of good. Like, when I didn't learn the basics, well, I guess I would have understood how to copy the basics, but I never understood. It was just constantly doing it. And
yeah, but, like, you know, something like that, it strikes me that a course like that seems to be more kind of predicated on preparing you for a job, preparing you for work. It strikes me that, like, you know, from you looking back right now, do you think you're ever going to be part of the workforce in that kind of way?
No, not when it came to web design there was a chance I was going to go into graphic design. In fact, when I filled out the CEO and went in, graphic design and multimedia were the two things that I had. In fact, I think I had graphic design as number one, and thank God I didn't study enough for my leaving cert, because I didn't get the points to get it. And I don't think I would have enjoyed that, because in multimedia I was still doing enough graphic design to be able to, like, I could probably become a graphic designer if I wanted now.
Yeah.
Just
yeah. So, okay, like, so post-college then, you know, like, when did you set up Feel Good Lost, and what were you doing between college and Feel Good Lost?
In multimedia, we had this module called experimental video, and it was weird, because the class was run by a lecturer who was giving me the most shit for doing a film in my last year. It was as if he just didn't want anyone to do film. He hated it. So it was probably a module he was just given to fill up his hours. But one of the projects in experimental video was to make an experimental piece of video to an instrumental track, and then you have to kind of do a, you know, the way college is, you have to kind of do a brief and explain what you're doing and the reasons for it. So I always a big music, massive music fan, and I was a big fan of a band called Broken Social Scene, who have an album called Feel Good Lost. And my very first music video was for this project, and I loved the phrase Feel Good Lost, and I just felt it captured the whole mood of that album amazingly well. And so my brief was to make a video that captured what it is to feel good lost. And once I made that, think it was in my, it might have been in my final year. I think it was my final year. Put that up online, and it, the song was a track called "Guilty Cubicles," and it didn't have a music video. So kind of yeah. Broken Social Scene fans, kind of on YouTube, it became the video for it, the unofficial video. And I kind of had a lot of fun doing it, and I stumbled upon this style, which was kind of, if you know any of my videos, at the start it was all very abstract, and I still do a lot of it with kind of using a lot of layers, and I create, and colors, and I create a kind of these ethereal sort of videos, and I stumbled upon that style for that, and I kind of enjoyed it, so I started just on my own spare time making videos for like artists I love, like Panda Bear or Clams Casino, and yeah. These sort of artists. But the songs didn't really have videos, so again, put them online, and they did quite well, and lots of views and lots of really nice comments. And that website, The Creators Project, did a big thing out of nowhere, best unofficial music videos on yeah. The internet, which is a great confidence boost. And after that, I was kind of like, well, maybe I can start to do this for a living. And I love the idea of, like, I think I had a website ready to go at the time, and it was like Brendan Canty Media or something, or like terribly embarrassing. So there were some directors out there who kind of had given their directing due or directing name like a band name.
Yeah.
And I always loved that. New Zealand directors, Special Problems. There's loads of them. Brothers, another one. And I was like, I like that idea. So. I coined the name Feel Good Loss.
Yeah. Say when all those unofficial videos were up there and you were getting kind of like being picked up by the Creators Project, did any of the artists at that stage kind of approach you about it? Or was it...
No, never really. I'd be very like good at emailing and trying to get onto people and always trying to get these videos out there, but I was never able to get through to them. Especially Panda Bear, he's impossible to track down. I was a massive... He was in a band called Animal Collective, and... I can never get through some.
I'll give you his number afterwards.
Cheers.
No problem. That's the payment. But like, no. So, obviously, you know, you're good at selling. You're good at kind of pushing yourself. But like, it's interesting the fact that all these videos were up there, and the artists themselves weren't getting in touch. Do you think, now, a couple of years on, I mean, are artists that aware of what kind of stuff like that's going up there?
They have to be aware. Like, if I was an artist, like I manage artists, and that's part of Feel Good Loss, and. On Twitter, I just search to see what people are talking about, and if someone did a fan video and it was good, or even if it wasn't good, I think I'd kind of appreciate the time that was put in. So it did kind of surprise me and disappoint me a small bit that even when I reached out to them, they wouldn't even have the time to just, especially because they were doing well. That was kind of a bit disappointing, but.
Okay, so like, you know, like at that stage, and you decided that there was something in this. You had that style, kind of like you want, and you were getting kind of good kudos from kind of music fans. So like, when you decide to kind of, I suppose, move on to the next step and try and make a living from it, what do you like? I mean, what was the case of going to artists? What was the first thing you did where you actually kind of like made some cash from it? And like, what was the process like?
To be honest, it took about a year and a half, 2 years to actually start making money. I recognize that you can't just walk into something like that and expect labels to give you money if you have nothing to back it up with, you know,
yeah.
Just unofficial videos. The first ones I probably made money off would have been one for maybe Jape. Richie saw my videos for Mott's.
Yeah.
I started to do official videos for acts who had no money, and the songs were amazing. And so I was kind of building up, and Richie saw that and was just like, will you make a video for one of his best tracks, Oldest Mind, which was great for me. It was kind of approached by an artist, and
yeah.
I loved Jake for
yeah,
years.
Yeah.
So that was quite amazing. Probably the first one was for Island Records. And that was through Mott's, actually. I did a video for Mott's, and Mott's put out a track on Annie Mac's compilation, which were being put out by Island Records, and they had a lot of tracks that were out there and kind of summer hits on their label, but they, aside from that, they were putting on original tracks from bands, and the guy who was in charge of getting the video, this guy Jasper, asked Mott's manager who did the videos, and he recommended me, so they got in touch, and I did one for Mott's, and I think it was like £500, which was like amazing for me at the time. I did that. He loved it, did really well, and then they asked me to do another one for a band called the Luna George, who have since gone pretty big.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was.
Which video did you do for Lou and George?
A song called "Watching Over You." Yeah, it was kind of like on the bonus part of their album, but
yeah,
in my opinion, it's the best song.
Yeah. Okay, before we kind of delve into like the Feel Good Lost hits and such, go back to kind of like the unofficial videos you were doing. You know, I mean, like I know from kind of talking to say various creatives that like a lot of advertising agencies, a lot of brands, when they're looking for people to work with, they're always looking for younger directors, new directors, untried directors, yeah. Directors who haven't been sullied by kind of working with other people. Did you get those approaches at the start?
No, never. I think my work was too abstract or something. I remember I had done a load of abstract videos, and it was like I was churning out like videos every like probably 2 videos a month or something like that, and it was building and building and building. And at one stage, and this is kind of like past the unofficial videos, but I remember I had this contact in the UK, and his friend was this big video commissioner, and he passed on my work to her. And I remember doing a Skype call with her, and she said that your work is brilliant, but it's not commercial enough. I wouldn't know where to start and where to sell it, and she was like, it would take years to get you into a position where you could do narrative videos. And I was kind of like, in my head I was like, I know that's not true, I can do narrative, but I wasn't going to say that, I had to go and prove it. So it was, while I was doing those videos, there was never really a kind of commercial side to it, because it was all so abstract.
Yeah, okay. So, like, I mean, after Jasper kind of, like, I mean, paid you well to do a Luna George and to do kind of, like, the Moss video, you know, was it the case then that you were getting calls from video commissioners on other labels?
No, it was mainly just him. He got me to do a series, like, I was kind of his go-to guy for doing these, I guess, smaller little abstract videos, songs they probably would never have commissioned a video for, but...
Right, okay. So, like, you know, what other videos would you have done in that period, in that kind of like early period?
I did a video for Slow Magic, which was, and he's done really pretty well for himself now. And this is when he was starting out. And he's an electronic producer from the Rockies, Colorado, somewhere. But I did that, and it became it became a Vimeo staff pick, which is a big deal online. Vimeo, which you probably know, is like, it's like a website like YouTube, but it's more for the artists, and it's a lot more, they're a lot more selective, and when they feature stuff, it's normally brilliant. And at the time, I was kind of like, it was my Bible, looking at everything on Vimeo. So to get a staff pick was kind of my dream, and it happened quite early. Mm-hmm. And after that, I got approached by lots of people. What was her name? What's your man in Arrested Development called? What's the
speech? Speech?
No.
The TV series.
Michael Cera's dad. Oh, yeah, what's his name? Anyway.
Tambor. Jeffrey Tambor?
No.
Any Arrested Development fans in the audience? No.
Anyway. Okay, forget about it. His sister got on to me anyway, randomly. But it was just these random people reaching out because they see these videos.
But did you find that as you were doing those videos, Brendan, that your style was changing?
No, it was like people were easily able to recognize my videos. I like, they weren't just like repetitive. I was coming up with new techniques, and I was always just experimenting, and I knew my limits and what I could do, and I was able to like work around them to get what I wanted. And by doing that, I mightn't get exactly what I wanted, but I'd find something else. And
yeah.
So, like, I had a lot of videos at the time were completely different from each other, but they were all within the same kind of look and feel, I guess.
Yeah.
But
yeah. They
were never, well, sometimes it might have been a bit repetitive.
You said earlier on there, like, you know, when you were doing the unofficial videos, that you were kind of like, you kind of consider yourself kind of good at selling yourself in a way and finding out more people. Did you find then, as you were kind of going up the levels, that, like, mean your business newest was improving?
I guess you're always making more contacts, and you're always learning how to deal with people, and you're always learning how not to do things, and how better to sell yourself. And I guess I was starting to make more money. When it comes to a business side of things, I'd always like push that kind of aside and just be like interested in making the next video and making the next video. And then there came to a point, which is kind of jumping ahead in the timeline, where I got someone on board to handle the business stuff.
Yeah. We'll come to that in a minute, because before that, obviously, you know, there was the Hozier video.
Yeah.
You know, and the Hozier video is what, like, I mean, most people associate Brendan Canty and Feel Good Lost with, you know. So, talk us a bit through that, because, I mean, that would have been, you know, that would have been 2013, so only 2 years ago, you know. So, I mean, at that stage, you had a fairly good kind of catalogue of videos.
Yeah.
You were known for what was going on. So, when you got the call from, I suppose, Niall Mucking gave you a call, Roger. So when you got that call from them, like, you know, did you know Hozier at that stage, or he was still fairly new?
I heard Hozier just trailing to music in Ireland, and it was sitting on like 300 or 400 views online. That Take Me to Church song, and his EP was a free download.
Yeah.
And what happened was I tweeted about it, and I was fairly well known, I guess, in circles for doing videos in Ireland, music videos. And like 20 minutes after I tweeted about the song, Roger got in touch.
Yeah, so that's Roger Quayle from Boobworks,
who's
labeled here in Ireland. So, did, like, I mean, let's use kind of Hozier, I suppose, as an example of how the video process works, you know.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, you talked earlier on here about Jasper, the guy from Ireland. He's obviously approached you. He's got a budget in mind. He might have a treatment. With Hozier, like, was their budget limited, and did they know what to do? Did they have an idea of the treatment, or were they leaving the treatment to you and said, here's the budget?
I think straight away they got on to me and they said they had a budget of €1,000, and I said this song needed a very cinematic narrative sort of music video. And it was soon after, remember I said that woman said your stuff wasn't kind of commercial enough,
yeah,
or you weren't doing narratives. Then I was kind of quite determined to do narratives, even before that phone call, and I had done one just before the Hozier video, and I was really trying to work on that. So when this song came along, it was like, it was kind of perfect for it. So they came up with a budget, and I just got it pushed up to 1,500. And I came up with, me and Connell, who I do a lot of my videos with, we worked through an idea, sent the idea over. And I think our idea wasn't the idea it was now, but it was quite similar. But it was more about the suppression of kind of intelligence, kind of in like a totalitarian state, and the burning was of the box. It was kind of supposed to be burning of books and stuff like that. That was the original idea. And Hozier came back, Andrew came back with kind of like, well, why don't we do it about the situation that was happening in Russia at the time. And it was big news, and which was, you know, obviously the suppression of LGBT rights kind of around the Sochi Olympics and stuff like that. And we thought that was a great idea, so we took that idea and rebuilt the story around that and all the metaphors and everything that went through it. And then he okayed it, and the next week we went and shot it. It's funny, like, that budget, which is so small looking back now, but we were making another video at the time. And we were shooting in Belgium, and I took that budget and paid for flights for the other video, so it really was done for nothing, really.
Yeah, yeah. And but, like, you know, it's had such an amazing effect. I mean,
yeah,
and obviously, you know, they pay you the €1,500. You deliver the video.
Yeah.
You don't see any royalties. You don't see any.
No.
Yeah. So as it's going up,
bit of a killer some days.
but like, you know, so once that video starts appearing, though, what's happened is that it's very noticeable that Andrew has been very generous in terms of, like, I mean, the credit that's been given.
Yeah,
to,
yeah.
You know, and, like, I mean, I was reading some interviews about that video, and, like, he's always credited that. Did that have a knock-on effect then in terms of Brendan Canty Inc.?
Yeah, massive. It was massive. The day before it got released, at around that time, I was talking to this guy Barry about coming on board with the business, and it was just the right time to actually properly set up Feel Good Lost the business, because the day after that came out, things just changed a lot. I got signed to a music video rep in London. I got signed to a production company in Dublin for doing commercials and stuff like that. So things really did start to pick up, and people were getting in touch with my agent then, wanting a video like the Hozier video. And
yeah, okay, but, like, I mean, you're kind of saying there that, like, the reaction came when the videos appeared online, not when it reached 50 million, 100 million. You know, it was like from the start, people realized, okay, this isn't actually a really, really strong video. Who's the guy behind it?
Yeah, I think everyone in this, I think the people who would commission music videos would be the people who would, like, they'd see this video suddenly surge in views, and, like, in one day, in the first day, it hit 100,000 within a week it was like a million, and like all of these people are just watching music videos and looking out for the new artists, and everybody had missed out on Hozier. And sure, you remember at Hardworking Class Heroes, and I think like 2 weeks after, and like 47 A&Rs flew over to see him. So like those are all the same people who are watching the video, and if a video has that much of a reaction from an unknown artist with no money behind it, it will get attention.
Okay, so like, you know, so then obviously your agent yourself like are getting calls about other videos. You said there, but like, I mean, say that the MovieWorks had €1,500 to spend on that video. When you're dealing with labels, then I mean, obviously there's let's talk a little bit about that in terms of like, I mean, have you kind of seen some insane budgets, or is it kind of realistic? Because back in the day, you know, I mean, like, remember those videos for Missy Elliott that like, you mean, that Hype Williams was making back in the day? I mean,
yeah.
There's millions of budgets. So have you been looking for €1 million budgets?
Nah, it's weird the way it's kind of a really strange business to in my position to make money off, because it's a strange business to make money off anyway, because the budgets compared to commercials are not that big, and the bigger budgets are the more commercial songs, which are normally the songs I don't like, and Feel Good Lost is kind of very built out of me doing videos for music that I love, so it's kind of like you kind of hit a wall when it comes to that art versus commerce sort of thing. And I feel like I can't do a video for a song I don't like, because it's very personal to me. Like the biggest budget I've done a video for would be $30,000. And most of the bigger artists, of the upcoming artists, $30,000 would probably be the most I've seen. Then if you go a level above that, like, which would be Codaline, I've seen you might get a $50,000 budget, and then for other artists, like you're talking your Taylor Swift's, $100,000 or maybe more.
Yeah.
The other day, I got asked to pitch on a music video for an unknown artist for $100,000. I think it was in this boy band called The Wanted or something. It was terrible, but it was $100,000. Yeah. But it's always like, why is the budget so fucking good for this?
Yeah.
Worse.
But okay, but like, you know, let's talk then about like, you know, how you negotiate with like, I mean, with labels, because say labels approach you about doing a video for a new act, there's obviously a video commissioning editor in there,
yeah.
Right? Then there's also an A&R man, there's a marketing department. You know, how complicated does it become? Because we know say from kind of like, I mean, Hollywood lore, that when it comes to films, there's so much fuckery involved.
Yeah.
With like a label, even with something like $30,000, is there a lot of backing and forth? A lot of people want to stick their oar in when they shouldn't.
Yeah. Massively. At labels, people just like, what's crazy with music labels is people move around all the time. Like, one person could be at Warner 1 week, and then 2 months later they'd be getting onto you from Columbia, and you're just kind of like, what's going on? But people come in and they try and make their mark, and like, if you're a video commissioner, or if you're involved in a marketing team and you get this video, you're going to want to make it look like you're doing your job, or you're good at your job. So people just sometimes, and sometimes they're right and they have a good opinion, but a lot of the time they're just saying things for the fucking sake of it, and you have to change it because they're your client, and you know that it's just, sometimes it's so clear that it's just someone in there just having their say, and it's and just so they can kind of, when the CEO or someone comes over and it's just like, oh, I made them pull up his sleeves or take his hat off and that, and it's, you know, it's.
Okay, let's go back then, kind of like, you know, to, I suppose, Feel Good Lost then, you know. So obviously the Hozier video has, you know, it made your reputation as a video director, but like, you know, Feel Good Lost is more than just about making videos, you know. And at that stage, was the management side of things, that creative side of things, was that kicking in as well?
Yeah, that was kicking in a good while ago. So as I said, I always wanted my job or Feel Good Lost to be a mixture between directing and design, but because I was doing a lot of music videos, I was always very intrigued by the process of when you have a music video and it gets out there and websites pick it up and one of the artists might get signed or something. I was kind of able to like watch that just from like my bedroom in Ballincollig and be like, how did that happen, you know? It always intrigued me. So when I came across a young producer from Ballintemple called Ian Ring, I was like, he was just making kind of dubstep, really kind of commercial dubstep, which I wasn't really into, but it was sonically just brilliant. Like, and I was like, this guy is really talented. And we started exchanging music and stuff like that. I didn't really like any of the music he was giving me, but I was sending him stuff, and he was like, I've never heard anything like this before. So he decided that he could try and make stuff like that. At the time, it was like your likes of Purity Ring, Star Slinger, Clams Casino,
yeah.
Gold Panda, all of this kind of music that was coming through. And then...
What was this new? Just shit dubstep?
Yeah. So he went and made a few tracks, and my girlfriend, Rachel, who claimed to be a singer, all the girlfriends I've had have always been singers. So I was like, oh, will you go in and try and sing on a track? And she was brilliant. Like, she wrote brilliant lyrics, and it just came together. And
you sound surprised.
I was surprised, because, you know, you're always just like, oh, is this going to work? I don't know. And it's your girlfriends. You're kind of just like, oh, it would be great to get a singer for this. And she's like, I'll do it. And you're like,
You can't say no.
You can't say no. And if she's crap, it's going to be hard to say she's crap. But luckily, she was really good. And so they got it, like, 3 or 4 songs together and put together an EP. And I was able to, like, do all the artwork for it and do the videos for it. And I knew kind of people in blogs who would do me favors and stuff. So I was able to, like, create this package and get it out in the right places, not just Ireland, like kind of the international online sort of.
So that was Young Wonder.
That was Young Wonder, yes, yeah, the name of the band, yeah,
yeah.
Young Wonder, and that did quite well. So, and you know, people were getting onto us, and I was making more contacts, and that would help with videos as well, and so that was kind of going really well, and they ended up playing all the festivals, and they supported Alt J in London, and just that was just some of the highlights of it. So, and I released the record on Feel Good Lost. I liked the idea of it becoming a music label, and considering I was doing all the work labels do for it, it just seemed quite a natural thing.
Yeah.
And I love the idea of Feel Good Lost becoming this bigger thing, like a Warp, if I'm talking about on a really high level, of just developing local acts and with all our resources being able to do all this sort of stuff for them,
yeah,
without having to outsource a lot of money. And then I met this guy called Owen, who was in a band called Hush Warcry in Cork as well, and amazingly talented band, and I was kind of helping them out, and then they broke up, and I put Owen with Ian, and they formed this band called Talos, and we have 2 songs out, but he's just back writing more. But yeah, it was kind of developing the whole time, and then, as I said, and I guess we'll come to Barry came on board.
Yeah.
He's the A&R for Sony in Ireland, and he's ran his own labels himself, and more experienced businessman who understands the music world. So he definitely, I co-managed the acts with him then. And
because you said earlier on there, when it came to kind of like, I mean, that you were talking about business, and like you said, you much prefer to make the videos to the bands, you know, leave all the business alone. So have you but you still have oversight in terms of business stuff.
It's not like I don't understand it. I just neglect it. I get so busy that I just neglect it, like I would have done in school or anything like that.
Yeah,
or things
yeah.
I'm just not interested in.
Yeah. So what you've done then with Feel Good Lost is Feel Good Lost. It sounds to me like a fascinating idea, because it's this kind of agency for all the creative stuff you're doing in terms of graphic design, packaging, videos. But then it's a management side. You've got a management side, because you're managing Young Wonder, you're managing Talos, but it's also a label, because you're releasing the kind of stuff as well. I mean, there are other kind of entities like that. You know, it just seems to me that in terms of the music industry right now, there seems to be entities like that. They're the most interesting ones, because I mean, they can control everything. They can actually package things right. Have you kind of found, what's been the kind of feedback from, say, the traditional record industry, the Jaspers and the likes of this world, those people, to what Feel Good Lost is doing that way?
It's kind of hard to know, because I was only talking to someone the other day, it works in my advantage not being in London. But I've heard things recently, like I did a video on one of the big budget things I was talking about. I did it through Columbia for this band called Seafret, and I just heard through the grapevine someone mentioned that I have a label and all that sort of stuff, and they were well aware of what I do. So I guess I think it leaves people with a sense of intrigue about what's this guy about, you know. I don't know, like, I talked to my agent recently, and I was... And she reps a lot of really good music video directors, and I asked her who's her busiest director, and she was like, you by a mile. And I honestly, it took me by surprise. So I think the whole, I definitely think me being not from London helps, but I think me having all of these other music labels, management, I don't know, it creates a nice...
It creates interest, but like it also, given the way the industry goes, I mean, given the way the fact that major labels operate like Real Madrid in terms of buying Galacticos, you know, like there may well be an approach, or has there been approaches from labels, but
we have closer ties. Sub label or something.
Yeah, like you know, I mean, like I know from the past that's how labels like to operate. You know, they see something's going on that's quite interesting and intriguing, and then they kind of move into own you. They want to brand you. They want to brand you Sony.
It's
Sony Canty.
It does have a ring to it. We've never gotten approached like that. I've been asked to become a scout in Ireland for like Polydor and stuff, by Richard, but that never, it was all just kind of talk, it never happened, and it was never attached to Feel Good Lost, and and when we came to release Talos's first record, we were asked if we want to take money from them to finance the record, still put it out to Feel Good Lost, but they were bankrolling it, and that never kind of happened in the end, so I guess that's kind of it. But
obviously, you know, given your interest in the past in music and kind of like video and all that, you're observing the music industry close up now. You know, what I mean, you talked earlier on about the bands playing festivals. You know, you've got kind of like enough contacts that you know how the major labels operate. What is your view of the record industry? Like, I mean, what is your view of the music industry? Do you think is it of den of iniquity? Populated by dogs and scoundrels? Or is it worse than that?
I don't know. It's like anything else. There's good people and bad people running it. I'm constantly surprised by the amount of shit that gets signed, and you're getting 20 or 25 grand budgets, and you're just kind of like, this is terrible. Like, and it goes nowhere. And I've done videos for bands who are signed to majors, and they go nowhere. And then it seems, and I've seen artists who get signed and end up having no control over videos, like. I remember I pitched on a Codeline video and I didn't get it, and we kind of know them, and we bumped into them at Eurosonic in Holland, a festival, and I wouldn't ask, but Colin, my buddy, was like, did you get the pitch, Brendan? And they're like, we don't even look at that sort of stuff. And I was kind of like, that side of the music industry, I hate when they just take a band and they just manufacture something around it, and they've got absolutely no say in it. I hate that. But then when you get the likes of, I guess, your Lana Del Rey's, or even your Hozier, I guess, has a lot of control, and.
The same case of Hozier. I mean, Hozier is now kind of signed to Universal, Island Universal over here, and Columbia in the States. He's made a lot of videos since. Have you worked with him since?
Straight after they were giving me the pitch and they wanted me to do the next... Actually, it was funny. His song, From Eden... Actually, no, straight after Take Me to Church, we got asked to pitch on Sedated, which I loved. I thought it was an amazing track. And then we pitched a really good idea, and then he got signed just after we got asked to do the video for it, and they kind of put that single on the back burner, and then From Eden was the next. And we came up with an idea for that, and they kind of exclusively wanted us to do it. We came up with an idea for that. They didn't really like our idea. Then Andrew came up with an idea for it. We thought his idea was okay and we were willing to do it. And then the label didn't like his idea and came up with their own version of his idea and expected us to make it. And I hated it. Like, and so I was kind of like, I knew that if I didn't do this video, I'd probably lose exclusivity of doing his other videos. But I knew also if I made that video, it would have been shit because I didn't like it at all. And that might have been worse or something.
Yeah.
So I just said no, I don't want to do it. And after that, it was done. I didn't get asked to do any more videos.
Right. Okay. So that's a kind of a creative decision you took, you know. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, it's interesting because it's like the way your kind of career has progressed. You know, you have taken those risks.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, another person might easily have kind of went, okay, I'll happily do what the label does. You know.
Yeah.
It's like, and then you kind of like you end up kind of being burnt out. You end up kind of like feeling like a prostitute because you're assuming you're paying for the money.
It's just not. The money is not worth it. I mean, you get 20 grand. Like, I go back to that Seaford video, and this kind of ties back into the question you asked earlier about label people. Getting too much involved. We did this video for this band Seaford, and it was a lovely.
I've never heard of Seaford before now.
Don't check it up because I'm not happy with the video. Okay. but it was a very kind of Where the Wild Things Are-esque sort of video, and it was a really nice concept, and they just had too much say in little stuff, like and I wanted the animal to kind of be, it was like this creature, this kind of like bear-like kind of creature, and he had horns, and I wanted to kind of humanize him because he was supposed to represent a human that you see at the start of the video, and we just had kind of ribbons on him, stuff to make him less animalist, and just little shit like, we hate the ribbons, they have to go. And you're just like, but it's just so subtle, it's just nice. They're like, we have to go, we've had board meetings. And you're like, weird board meetings in like...
Board meetings about ribbons in a band that we
And they are, they're in these boardrooms in fucking London having these meetings, and you're just tearing your hair out in Ballincollig, like, you know. that's what's kind of funny about the whole thing. Like, all these little things are so serious, and that was just a stressful shoot because they were just so on top of everything, and I really didn't enjoy it. And that budget, it was so much stress, and it was a 20 grand budget, which was like one of the biggest ones up there. I've worked on a few. I worked on a 30 grand one or whatever, but. It was a 20 grand budget, and by the end we made fuck all out of it because it was such a production. And I was kind of sitting there going, what was the point in that? I didn't even... The song was good, but as a good pop song goes, but it wasn't... I didn't love it, like, you know? I liked it enough to do a video for it, but I didn't love it, and in the end it was kind of like, dude, that was kind of shit, you know?
Let's leave the suits to one side then, you know? Yeah. Let's kind of like go back to the creative side and collaborations and kind of like cooperation with people, you know? Everyone in your videos, you look at them on YouTube, there's a long list of people afterwards who worked on the video, you know, be it the camera people, be it whatever, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, let's talk a bit about like the relationship with those people, you know, and how you kind of maintain that relationship. And also, in terms of kind of like the actual videos being shot as well, the actual artist, you know? I mean... Like, are there artists you come across who are really interested in kind of the video process who will talk to you about it afterwards?
Yeah.
Or do most of them kind of just see it as nerd kind of, I suppose, the box we take? So two parts. One, the collaborators and the people who work on the video, and two, the artists.
Yeah, there's artists who are heavily involved in the videos, like Andrew would have been. Well, I wouldn't say heavily involved. He'd come up with an idea, but he'd also be like a guy that would be like, I love your videos and I trust you. Feel free to take on my opinion, or feel free to don't. You know, this is mine. And like, that was really cool. And there's other artists who you just would never even talk to. And I do hate that. Yeah. I hate when... Because their music is obviously personal to them, and you've created a video based on their thing, and you don't even... There's not even a tweet. You don't even talk to them. I just find that I hate the impersonality of that. I did a video for Gavin James recently, and while he wasn't involved with the video process, he's very friendly, and he'd be getting in touch with me afterwards and stuff like that. So it depends on the people.
Yeah. And then in terms of people who work on the videos, you know, I mean, like, obviously you're paying them because, I mean, there's budgets there.
Yeah.
But, like, also, I mean, there's a management process involved there as well.
Yeah.
Has that been easy enough for you to take on?
When we made the Hosier video, up until then, it was me and Connell. And me and Connell went to college together. We did for our final year project, we did that short film, which we had to fight to do. And he wasn't a filmmaker, he was a photographer. But through that process, he became a filmmaker. And we made all the videos kind of together. I made some of my own. The Hosier video was us going around with a camera, filming everything, editing everything, directing everything, doing everyone's job, really. Like, and it got to a stage where people were expecting more, and you kind of had to look like you were filling up the budget, or it was just too much responsibility with label people expecting stuff, expecting makeup, expecting this, expecting... that who's the DP on this, is like, we are. It's just like, no, you're not. You know, it's kind of a tough thing. You have to make yourself look bigger, and we struggled with that in the year. Like, the year after the Hosier video, wasn't that easy to get work. Loads of people were coming at us with briefs and stuff like that, but we weren't winning jobs because we weren't big, and we weren't a proper company, you know. Well, we were just setting up, but it was just really difficult to take on these big budgets and deliver them in our total DIY way.
It's that's a fascinating observation, mm-hmm. because I mean it's something that, you know, you could obviously do feel good loss from a laptop and a mobile, but like, I mean, if the labels always want to, they always want more, you know. I'll tell you a full story after this, but like Sony, in terms of perception, you know, we did a label many years ago and they came over to meet us in Dublin, and we didn't have an office. So basically I was living in a house. There's a basement in the house. We commented a basement and pretended the basement was our office, you know. So the two Sony executives came over, they sat there for the day. It was amazing, it was really good fun. Then there were a good 3-hour meeting, and these were the days before mobile phones. And then Jeremy Pierce, the head guy, said, "Oh, I need to make a phone call." And I was like, "Shit, phone. The phone's in the kitchen." So he went into the kitchen to make a phone call. Unfortunately, my housemate was getting up there around midday, so Jeremy's making his phone call to his office back in Dublin, and my housemate's there in his boxer shorts scratching his nuts. But like, it's perception. It's totally perception. They want to see the office, you know?
They want to see the office, not the same thing, a bedroom in Ballincollig and my mother's house. You know, it's like, it's... there came a point where it was like... When we made our first commercial, that was the first time where you have to work with these people. And I remember being like, we shoot stuff ourselves, we do this ourselves. And they were like, no, you don't, and you can't. This is a bigger deal. You have to just direct, because there's a lot of work in just directing. And that's something we didn't actually know. Actually, until then, I was kind of like, oh, so that job we're doing is directing. You know what I mean? All of the other stuff is, you know.
Yeah.
And that was kind of a big eye opener. And
so, like, I mean, those commercial jobs, though, when you start working on them, Brendan, like, you know, again, it's another learning process. And it is the amount of faffing and kind of like, you know, like jobs worthy kind of stuff, as bad as the labels, or is it a bit easier?
I think it's easier, and for all the reasons that I was worried about it at the start. So, excuse me, we did a TG Cahir job, and it was the only small job to get us into it, and that was okay. We're dealing with the creatives, and that was all fairly smooth. And then after that, we pitched on a job for Gas Networks Ireland, like a campaign of three videos, something, and it was like a 300 grand budget. And that was just for production. I think it was 2 million overall. And I was like, look, and a very conservative client. They were Bord Gas. They were rebranding, such a big deal. I was like, I never thought we were going to win it, and we did. And suddenly we're in this world of like having to have pre-production meetings, pre-production meetings. Every single little bit of the process has to be like signed off to a T before you ever go on the shoot, which terrified us, because we never storyboard. We shot lists and stuff, but we're always quite loose and we always kind of do things off the cuff. And suddenly we are in a world where you cannot do that. It's not allowed. You have to do all these things and get them signed off. So the whole world is built so nothing can go wrong pretty much on the day, unless something berserk happens or something. And so going into these pre-production meetings, I was totally nervous. Like, and then you go in and you're kind of like, this is kind of easy. Everything's been signed off. So literally on the day of the shoot, you're kind of like, you know what you're doing. There's no one really standing you over you going, I want this or this to be changed or that. I
mean, maybe it's all decided in advance.
It's all decided in advance. And it's like, it was kind of brilliant, like, you know. And the money is like, comparing it to like Seaford video, with 30 grand budget and making nothing, and it's loads of stress because there isn't time. And music videos, the turnaround is stupid. It's like, you might get awarded a video. So you pitch on a video, then you might get awarded it. You might have like 3 weeks to turn it around, which is just insane. So there's a lot of risk as well, where it's like, you might plan a scene. Like I did a video for All Twins, and it was shot in this kind of really ornate room in this old kind of estate house in Meath. And we had a daytime scene, and the daytime scene looked amazing. The light coming through the windows looked amazing. And the nighttime scene was supposed to look very intense. But then when we got to it, it didn't look intense because it was in an ornate room, something that I should have foreseen, but didn't. And because there was no pre-production meetings, there was no being able to rent the gear, being able to like do test it out with your tech teams, it was just a risk. And on the day you get it wrong and you're just like, fuck. And you have to like you have to be creative and find a way around it and make the video good, which I did, and I'm proud of myself for doing that. But in commercials, that would never have happened. You know?
It's interesting because it's a difference between you know the very creative side and record labels, and like he's very creative and they're expecting a lot of you. And it's stress, but the budgets aren't huge. Whereas with the corporate side, the budgets aren't huge, and the reason why it's delivered is because you say every single step is like it's planned out in advance.
Yeah, exactly. And the budgets are great. Like, the budgets are amazing, and it was the first time I was like, whoa, this I can actually make proper money out of this. Yeah. And dealing with clients, maybe I could see some directors not really getting that, especially when you're dealing with, again, like you're dealing with like the managing directors of Board Gosh, and you're just like 2 years out of college. You know, you're just like, suddenly you're in meetings with these people and they're the directors, you're the directors that they're paying a fortune to get, and it's kind of a weird dynamic. You know, it's, when would you ever be in that situation?
But it's interesting because, like, I mean, they're after you because they see you as fresh in that corporate world.
Yeah, I guess, yeah, and it's mainly the creatives from the ad agency would have sold you to them and stuff like that, but it was just funny. I think I dealt with that world quite well because my dad runs a PR company and I'd have always done little corporate videos, so I was always kind of used to that process. But I enjoy doing commercials. I prefer doing commercials than I would doing a music video to a song that I didn't really like or something.
So have you had more commercial work than since Board Gosh?
No, it was kind of annoying. We did the TG Carter job, which is a small job, and then we won these Gas Networks Ireland jobs, which we had no right to do. I mean, the only reason we won it was I went into the briefing meeting and the creators were experienced creatives. One of them, I don't know if you've ever come across him, this guy called Shane Madden. Lovely guy. He's renowned to be one of the nicest guys in making ads in Dublin. And I've worked with younger creatives and they'd be more nervous to take a risk on a younger director, but he was very calm. And he gave us a lot of confidence. And in there, so what the ad agency does is they would have come up with a concept for the ad and that would have been signed off by Board Gosh. And then they'd bring in directors to make the ad that's been signed off on. So we come in and they brief us. But they were like, look, we have these three ads. These are the concepts behind the ads. We don't think they're all that great. They're kind of boring. So feel free to bring your own ideas to them. And I had I was just after like a talk or something that morning. I came into it very confident, so I was like, why don't you do this and that? And they were like, these are all great ideas, just do it. So I rewrote the ads, and that's kind of how we won it. I think they were like, when they pitched the ideas back to Board Gosh, they're like, here's the four directors' pitches. This one's a bit different than the ones you signed off on. They're all like, oh, it's better. And we won it. Anyway, going back to the question, at the end of that, we had done, which suddenly our commercial reel had gone from one little Board Gosh thing to four, and one is a campaign, like a big budget campaign. And I was like, this is going to be amazing. We were signed with a production company called Piranha Bar, and a woman called Lorraine signed us, a producer. And like producers, you become so close to producers, they're like, they just run the show. Like, I mean, I've never seen a harder job in my life than a producer's job. It's insane the amount. When you're dealing with a 300 grand budget, you're dealing with staff or crew or whatever of 100 people, logistics of getting like 50 shots done in like 3 days over 10 locations, and they're organizing this to a T, from catering to everything. It's just insane. Like, but she was like our mother, like up in there, right? And she knew we were new to it, so she kind of had to, like, she'd done some huge ads over in the UK, so she was kind of bringing us through it. And then we just finished the ads, and I was staying in her house up in Dublin one weekend over Christmas after the ads, and she just told me that she was leaving Piranha Bar, which was the production company. And it was a bit like, fuck's sake. And we just signed with them, we were on their reel, everyone knew them and came to them, and she was going to set up her own company, and she wanted us to come. And like, I loved everyone in Piranha Bar, but they were super... Everyone was super chill and laid back, and I think I figured that we'd just end up doing ads that didn't really suit our style. I mean, if I wanted to go and make loads of money now, I could just go and do those ads, but I don't want to. I want to do something of a certain style in the hope that I'll land somewhere where people want to come for me to doing the cooler ads or the better ads. And Lorraine protected us from those ads, and she had a vision for us. But she was also just starting up a new company, which obviously is going to take 3 or 4 months. Then she has to get out there. Then she has to go to all the ad agencies and meet all these people. So we had to go with her in the end because she was our mother, and it just had to happen. Like, we couldn't just break our ties with her. But so it's been it was kind of steamrolling, Feel Good Lost doing these commercials, Piranha Bar pushing us big to we're leaving Piranha Bar now, and it just took about up until now. Only now, 6 months later, she's has her website up. Well, she got it up about a month and a half ago, and
what's
she's
company called?
Hinterland. And she's getting her name out there, but it's just been slow, and that was kind of a real kick in the teeth. Even though I think we definitely made the right decision, and it will be better in the long run. But it's kind of been frustrating that we weren't able to follow up.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Last question for me before asking questions for the audience. You know, I mean, like you've talked there through the kind of like the music side of things. Obviously, the corporate side of things will be getting going now. That the Hinterland's up and going. I mean, what do you see as a future for like Feel Good Lost? I mean, it strikes me you have a good thing going from a band called.
It's going really good, and I'd really like one of our acts to break. I think Talas can, and I feel like we'll have failed him if he doesn't, because his songs are really strong. And that's the kind of one thing we've developed acts to a certain point, but we've kind of failed to take him an extra level. Not fail, because you're always just learning, but that's something that needs to happen considering the investment we're putting in.
And what do you think kind of like mean is needed to get to that next level? Is it an input from another person? I mean, if you've got the business side, the creative side, is an input from another person? Is it like, you know, the fact that you need to sign different kind of act?
I don't know. I always use Hozier as an amazing example, and Hozier, I'm so lucky that happened from a management point of view, because I was able to watch a track go from nothing to being the biggest track in the world within the space of like 6 months, and that it went that way because in a very organic way. And I had a really interesting meeting recently with this guy called Christian Tattersfield, who was the CEO of Warner. He signed David Gray, Damien Rice, all these people, and I got a sit down meeting with him, and I asked him, at the time we were putting out we put out this track by Talas called Tethered Bones, and we don't have much money, but we paid a radio plugger to get it to radio, and it just went nowhere. And we were doing the same thing with Young Wonder, and it went nowhere. It's just a waste of money. And I asked him, I was like, how do you get things to radio? Is it like, we've been paying radio pluggers? He was like, it's pointless. He was like, radio is controlled by, it's all about power. Like, it's all about, he says he could get, and they look after Gavin James, and I got the meeting because I did a video for him, but he was like, I had dinner with the head of Radio 1 last week, and it's through those relationships that those sort of, that's, and he was like, it's not really even about money. And then the other extreme example was Hozier snowballing. Like, you know, I remember, and like, the Take Me to Church is a song that if the video didn't happen, it could have just went nowhere. And that's you're talking about the biggest song in the world. I remember talking to a good friend of mine, Dave Mack in Red FM, and I remember having an argument with him because they weren't playing enough Young Wonder at the time. And I used Take, and it was just a few weeks after to Take Me to Church had come out, and I was like, you should be playing more Irish music. And he was like, oh, you know, he was just had his arguments against it, and said they were trying, or it needs to be like Today FM need to be playing, and all this needs to be happening. And I was like, what about Take Me to Church? I was like, that's doing really well online. He was like, that short track will not work at radio. And like a month later, it was just like, Red FM fresh for new music, Take Me to Church. I was just like, this is insane. Like, it's no one takes
But it's fascinating about taking the church, because like, you know, that track from the minute you heard it, you knew there was something there. And I remember having an argument with well, I didn't win the argument, with Jazz Summers, the manager, and he was desperate to kind of like get involved with Hozier, and he was obviously pushed off the pass, you know. But I was kind of saying, like I'd seen Hozier live, it doesn't convince me. He's a cabaret man.
But he said
was that song, he would go to war with that song. He said he would go into record labels, he would go into radio stages, and he would fight with people to get them to play that song, because he knew that song was going to kill her.
Yeah. But like, even Ruby Works at the time, I remember we finished the video, and we finished it on a Wednesday. Normally when you finish a video, it takes maybe about at least 2 weeks for it to come out or something, unless sometimes it might come out in a few days or whatever. But they were like, well, when are you going to release it? Tomorrow. And I was like, okay, that's strange. He was like, are you going to get it premiered on different websites or whatever? I think it could be a pretty big song. They got it premiered on state.ie, which is like, it was just clear that they were just only focusing on Ireland, and they'd be happy to build this profile in Ireland. But they didn't have no idea how big it could have went either.
Yeah.
And you hear the likes of Caroline Downey, you know, saying that they always knew the direction was. They hadn't a fucking clue.
No one had a clue. I mean, you talked earlier on about the Hard Working Class Heroes gig they played when all the NR people came over, you know. And like I'd seen them before that, and I'm fairly arrogant. I just didn't see it. I mean, I thought he'd one fucking song. I thought it was like a Gaudier, you know, and somebody like me, you know. I didn't see it. And a lot of people could say that as well, you know.
Yeah.
But the thing is, like, once he had that one song as a trump card, and once he had the video as well, he could push it from there. And when you say about radio, it's really interesting, you know. It's only, like, you kind of said there, but, like, I mean, Red FM picked up maybe a month later, you know. It was only at the turn of this year, from 14 into 15, that Capital and all the commercial stations in England got on the back of Taking the Church, and that's when it charted.
Yeah.
And it's fascinating. Radio is just like, when like, you know, I don't see why, I don't understand ever why people pay money to radio pluggers, because it's like you're just pissing in the wind.
It is. It's the most stupid money you could ever spend. But going back to the question, and my point was, you could have a song like Take Me to Church, and unless something happens with it, it could sit there. And I believe we've had that with Talos' song Tethered Bones. I think that could have been a huge song. Young Wonder have a song called Sweet Dreaming, which I think could have definitely been a pop song. Maybe not to the level of Take Me to Church, but it could have done really well. So you asked me, what do you think the next step is? I don't know, but we're just constantly trying to figure that out, you know, and I think we're getting there. I definitely think having a bank of really strong songs to follow a big song up is definitely something to if you're an artist, will work in your favor, because like when we released Talos' song Tethered Bones, which did like has over a million hits online across YouTube and across SoundCloud and stuff like that, we had all the A&Rs coming in from all over the UK and America, and they're always kind of going, we love this, can we hear more?
Yeah.
And the more wasn't as strong as that track, and it's kind of like, it's hard to convince people.
But that's always been the way with the A&R process. I mean, back in the day when the A&R chase was going on, and they'd come in to see an act and say they need 6 months, and you always just think that was a fob off, but it's not, because in six, like, a band can develop so much in 6 months.
Yeah,
it
can.
You know?
Yeah. So I don't know. I think it's at the stage where the songs are so good now. It's something has to happen, and we have an album's worth of brilliant songs. So If we can't make that stick, then I'd be pretty disappointed. But I think we will. And then going back to like, what do I want Feel Good Lost to become? I don't know. This is kind of one of my things I struggle with at the moment. Is like, Feel Good Lost is being funded by wages that I should be making. You know, like we do Bored Gosh, and I'm taking a wage from Feel Good Lost every month. So, but the wage, if I was a director on my own, I would have made a good bunch of money from that. So it is a struggle using my, and music videos aren't a way to pay your way anyway.
Yeah.
So I'm taking those budgets and putting them into Feel Good Lost. And I love doing it, but and this is why I want some of the acts to hit, because we've been putting money into like Talos, and if they can start making money on syncs, good money touring and stuff, then Feel Good Lost will start to be able to finance it, and then it will make more sense being able to sign more acts and build the label more and and then hopefully I get more commercials and it just becomes a bigger thing, and eventually I'd probably like to go independent as a director then, and I don't know. Okay. It's kind of exciting that I don't know what it's going to be, you know.
Cool, okay. Any questions from the audience? Because we've rattled off in so many different directions.
Yeah.
I've actually completely lost track of where we're, and we're talking for an hour. So yeah, you're all still here, which means it's either raining outside, you've no home to go to, or you've got some questions to ask.
My question is about your friend. Your friends, it sounds like your friend before you started out together. Is that the case? And did it work? Can you see anything that didn't work, or do you have any suggestions around that if you didn't have any learnings from it?
You're talking about Connell, the guy.
Connell
is like a completely unique person, because I, in all my time, I've not had one argument with him. And I'm very much like, I feel bad because whenever I do these talks, I get so into it, and he gets barely mentioned, and he's such an integral part. But I couldn't do things without him, and it got to a point where, like, I normally come up with most of the ideas, and I'll bounce it off him, and that's kind of how it works. And it got to a stage where I was sharing 50-50 of director's kind of fees, and I was kind of a bit like, not that I've ever been like this, but I was a bit like, is that too generous of me or something? And we did videos where he was away and I was kind of like directing on my own, and I felt it did suffer, like not being able to just fall back on someone. He is an absolute and invaluable part of the process. And were we friends before that? We were friends in college, yeah. But I met him through college, and I was the one who, like, he made a short film in like second year, and we all had to do it. And his short film was the most embarrassing thing I've ever seen in my life. Like, but he was a brilliant photographer, and he learned through the process, and he just got better and better. And he's got a really good technical brain, and again, he's the most calming dude ever. So like, he's a bit like Louis Theroux. He looks like Louis Theroux, and he's got the presence of Louis Theroux, where he's always calming, he never freaks out, never really gets angry. And when you're on like Bord Gáis shoots and your first corporate jobs and things might go to shit, like that shoot was very smooth, but for an example, on the very last day, and these are the sort of, filmmaking is funny, you plan for all the big shots and the shots you think are going to be the most difficult, and it's the shots that are just so simple on paper are the ones that will kill you. And everything went so smoothly on Bord Gáis, except on the last day we had a shot of kids playing hurling in the rain, and we had rain machines, and it was in November we were shooting it, and it was cold, and the rain machine was freezing, so we had these bunch of kids getting soaked, and the shot I had storyboarded for wasn't working, and Lorraine, our producer, was just like, you need to get this fucking shot now, or like, we could be sued, like, if these kids get sick, and you have to get the shot. And I was like freaking out, and Con is just standing there being as calm as you like, and just being like, and then he'd step in and just be able to like just calm everything down and just like really help out with the shot. And that's where he's kind of really invaluable. Like, and actually it was coming up to that point where I was really just like, you know, I guess the money does talk a bit, and you're just like the director's fee on that would have been 30 grand, and you're supposed to split it, even though I'm taking a wage on it, but you're supposed to split it. And I was kind of like, Jesus Christ, like, you know, and it always does. And I remember, like, there was a week through that I'd booked a holiday to go to Iceland, and I had to go for a week, and he stayed there working. And when I came back, it was like, he was just miles better director or something, like, you know. And throughout that shoot, he was just, I've never seen him direct so well. And even on the music video since, he's just been brilliant. So it's just a really great relationship. And he's kind of like, I wouldn't really compare it. I don't know, what could I compare with other people's relationships with? Because he's just a kind of unique dude. I don't know if that answers your question.
Any more questions? Damien, Danny.
You still do the low budget stuff, yeah? Like the 1500 videos, or have you learned from that, or the better version? Given that you're obviously lost leaders,
it's a good question. It's actually something I'm kind of like I always really want to do it. Like I got a, I've been asked to do this video that I really want to do at the moment. And see, because our work has kind of come on a level in production value, it's kind of hard to go back. It's hard to do things with no budget and make them at this way I've kind of want my work to go and progress. Like I don't want to go back and do stuff I was doing a year or two ago, because you always want to improve and build on stuff. And to building on stuff, I think I touched on it earlier, but we're working with bigger teams now. And after the Gavin James video, we now work with DPs and we now work with all these people. And that's kind of, to improve as a director, that's where I see things going. But yet there are videos where I go, no, I'll try and do it in the old way. And I got to be better at saying no to them, because if I find a song I really love and it's just like, and I agree to do it for a low budget, and then a bigger budget thing comes in, it's kind of like, you have to push it to a side, but it's still a commitment that you've committed to, and that's when it gets tricky, and that's, I still try and take them on, it just gets harder and harder, and the Brendan that was taken on these videos 2 years ago is still inside me, and I get, it's just hard to take on these things, like, even like, I'm sure they're here now, Mary in the Opera House, I said I'd do like a promo video for that, and I was like, oh, I'll do it for nothing, blah, blah, blah. And I wanted to do it, and I came up with a good idea for it. And I went out and shot on a day, and the weather wasn't right. And then you're kind of like, oh, I have to go and reshoot this again? And you just fucking don't have time, and you've already committed something, and then you're letting people down. And that's kind of why it's hard to take on stuff, because you just end up kind of sometimes letting people down. Because I'm running a business now, and I'm paying two of my best friends to work with me, and you have to be able to pay them, like, you know.
Yeah.
I try my best to, but it's getting harder.
Danny?
I'm just interested in the dynamic of working with the big corporates. You're saying, yeah, what seems to be the class of great cake and commercial activity, the process actually pays dividends in terms of the smooth shoot. If you had your time over again, would you go and lose some time with a big production company and learn from someone else's mistakes, or would you go straight in the hard learning routes for the next?
Good question. Yeah, really good question. I kind of made a conscious decision not to go to London and work with a production company, not to go to Dublin, because I wanted to be a director, and I realized that the climbing the ropes could have taken years and years and years. And if you look at directors out there, most of them are doing music videos. It seems to be the way to get into the industry. I mean, you mentioned that a lot of corporations want the coolest director, and I don't think there's anything cooler to direct than music videos and films just take too long to make. So I decided not to go to London and try to do everything from Cork. And through making stuff, just videos, two videos a month, every month, I would never have learned that much stuff than I would have if I went through the route of working with a production company. But then again, it's like, it depends on what you want to do. Like if you want to be a grip, or you want to be a lighting guy, or if you want to be like a director of photography, then you almost have to go down those routes. So I think a director is different, though. If I was giving any advice to a young director, I'd say just make as many videos you can. And music videos, it really helps. Like I remember at the stage where I was making music videos, and there was people in Cork or in Ireland who were making music videos, and they were as talented a filmmaker as me. But the only difference was I had a better taste in music, and I was picking better songs, and I guess I had the balls to approach artists. And because you can't make a good music video to a terrible song, like, because it's soundtracks, you know, the terrible music soundtracks the video, and the video just becomes terrible by default. And and Take Me to Church is a powerful song, and it matched the powerful video, but you could take that video and put it to a terrible song and it would be a terrible video. So I don't know where I'm going with this, but yeah.
Any questions?
Have you used in your journal, you don't make your own equipment?
Yeah. Yeah. Dali's. We definitely did. I mean, never. We always kind of like were not the best at the most technical at building our own rigs and doing all that sort of stuff. We're pretty crap at it. We're really good at making do with our skills and our equipment. On those big shoots, there's just so much money to get the. It's not that you can't use them. You can use them, but I guess they just. You're working with big production companies who just own these equipment, you know, and GPs that have lists of what they want, and but it like it's. There still comes for a point to points where you're just like maybe one of them wasn't work or the cameraman just has to like take all the equipment off the camera and run with it. like that moment where we had to film the kids in the rain. It's like I think we had it on a tripod and a long lens, or we had it on a Steadicam. We had to just knock off the Steadicam and just like panically follow a kid, and suddenly everyone around, all the big budgets came back to like me making a film just, you know, in a forest in Cork. It was just the same thing. It was just like, get the shot, we're running out of time, the light's going, blah blah blah, kids are getting wet, run, follow the kid, try and get the shot. And I think that goes with the equipment, is like you can use the equipment, but on those commercials you just have, I mean, most of those equipment are great because equipment's expensive and you can't afford it, so you make do, and like and that's great, and those things you make can do it. But in the commercial level, it's just there's the budgets for that, and budgets have to be filled up. Yeah, exactly.
Cool. That's it. Please. Oh, of course, that's it.
If you weren't to do, you know, low budget, and somebody came to you with an idea, would you have a kind of idea of which guys or girls you'd send that person to that you can get?
I try and help out people as much as possible. That's happened a lot recently, where people have asked me to do a video and the song might be good, or the song might be crap, but the people are so nice or something. And I always try to push them in the direction of really good people.
Who would those people be at the moment? Who's the next Brendan Canty?
Oh, I don't know. There's a really good guy in Sligo called Kevin McLaughlin. He's really good. Really good. It's Kevin Freeney is quite good in Dublin. It's just Kevin's. Kevin's seems to be.
Kevin Canty.
there are some good people. There's a lot of good filmmakers, but again, it's sometimes they find it hard to get the stuff out there. And I think, again, going back to my point, is the right music helped me to do that.
Cool. That's great, everybody. Please give a round of applause to Brendan Canty.
Thank you.
Thanks very much to Anne and all in Eventbrite Cork as well. Hope you've enjoyed yourselves. We see you all again soon. If you want to know more about Banter, check out thisisbanter.com. Thanks very much for your time, patience, and safe home.
Thanks a million to Brendan for his time and candidness, and to Anne and all at Eventbrite for their hard work on this event. This Banter podcast was produced by our super duper series producer, Tanya White. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please rate us and spread the word. Tell your friends about us, recommend us on your favourite social media network, leave a review or a rating on the iTunes store, and don't forget to subscribe. You can check out thisisbanter.com for news while we're up to Banter. See feelgoodloss.me for more on Brendan, and we'll be back next week with another podcast. Until then, goodbye and take care.